Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is A.B. Dawji with the remnants of the flu, so you'll hear some spluttering and coughing through the program. And of course, this is the big picture where we analyze and dissect international news and events with something of a jaundiced eye. And of course, a healthy dose of jeering at delinquent politicians and assorted chorwans. We try to make sense of what's happening in this crazy world, and usually we fail. It's madness out there, folks. Madness. And so, as usual, we begin with the light stuff. The stories that have you laughing out loud or maybe raising an eyebrow in total disbelief. While the first story has both of these, makes you laugh and at the same time have you throw your hands up in the air and say, ish, or maybe, aibo. But dear listeners, if you are Muslim and you are traveling on a plane, especially an American plane, here is a very serious warning. Do not flush the toilet twice. Did you get that? Do not flush the toilet twice. Yes, I know. You are sitting there thinking, what has A.B. Dawji been talking? Well, dear listeners, I assure you that I am in sound mind and everything will make sense when you hear this story. It was on Al Jazeera and, of course, it was also viral on social media. Two Muslim men have called for an investigation after they say they were racially profiled. And the American Airlines flight to Dallas, Texas, they were traveling on, was cancelled. Issam Abdullah said his flight was cancelled because the aeroplane crew was, in his words, not comfortable to fly with him and a second passenger, Abdul Rauf Al-Khawalde. Both of them were on board. Al-Khawalde said he has been a frequent flyer since 1989. These are, of course, community leaders in their own towns in the United States. So he's been flying since 1989, and that there was no reason for security officers or crew members to be suspicious of him. He said at the news conference on Thursday, which was called by the Council for American Islamic Relations, that's CARE, as you all know. He said, "I have been a loyal customer since 1989. I have taken hundreds of flights with American Airlines. And to be treated with disrespect, suspicion, to be racially profiled for absolutely no reason, this is absurd, unacceptable, and un-American," he said. American Airlines defended its decision in a statement to U.S. media saying the flight was, in their words, canceled due to concerns raised by a crew member and a passenger. It continues, American and all of its regional partners have an obligation to take safety and security concerns raised by crew members and passengers seriously. Well, an airline spokeswoman told the Dallas Morning News that the company has reached out to Al-Khawalde and Abdullah to better understand their experience. The airline noted that the flight was operated by its regional partner, Mesa Airlines. A Mesa spokesman told U.S. media on Thursday that the safety and security of our customers is our top priority and we are conducting thorough investigation of this matter. Abdullah and Al-Khawalde were booked to travel from Alabama to Texas on an American Airlines flight on September 14th. According to Abdullah's account, the flight was initially delayed by 15 minutes due to maintenance issues. Later on, it was delayed again. During the interruption, he said he decided to go to the restroom. Of course, we know it as the toilet. So he went in and did what he had to do. And then he said, "When I opened the toilet door, the flight attendant was standing by the door like she was eavesdropping. I was really shocked." 10 minutes later, the crew requested the passengers to leave the aeroplane, and he said that shortly after that, the pair was approached by a security person and later by an FBI agent. Abdullah said he was told by the officer that a passenger and an airline staff were not comfortable with flying with him after he went to the restroom and flushed the toilet twice. He says it was really humiliating. I felt discriminated against my ethnicity and my religion. Did you get that? Let me read that part again. An airline staff was not comfortable with flying with him after he went to the restroom and flushed the toilet twice. Serious stuff, right? This dirty, rotten, stinking Muslim terrorist flushed the toilet twice. What a dangerous act. And the air hostess was listening. She put her ear against the door of the toilet to listen to what was happening there. I wonder if she heard him leaving some loud bombs. Dear listeners, I never heard anything so ridiculous in my life. He flushed the toilet twice. Listen here. I'm sure that many of you have used the toilet on the plane. When you flush, actually no water flushes things away. It's done by a vacuum, like a suction force. It sucks out whatever is there. And actually, as you know, it doesn't do a very good job. And often you have to flush the second time. But khabardar, as a Muslim, you should never do that unless you want to be chucked off the plane. But in the end, I'm still wondering how, if you flush a toilet twice on a plane, you could be regarded as a very dangerous person. Can someone please let me know what's the answer to that question? Well, as I told you, listeners, we are living in a crazy world. It's a world that's moving at a very fast pace. Anything can suddenly happen, and usually does. A small spark can set off a forest fire. Yeah? Small spark, and you can have a forest fire. And the best recent example is Tunisia. The ex-president of Tunisia, Zain al-Abidine Ben Ali, died last week in Saudi Arabia at the age of 83. Why Saudi Arabia? Because a small spark, a very tiny one in fact, in 2011 made him and his family pack up and run for their lives before they got burnt with this forest fire. That spark was a young chap called Mohammed Bouazizi. I've spoken about him previously also. Mohammed Bouazizi, a fellow who was selling vegetables in the small town of Sidi Bouzid. And some government officials, one lady in particular, she came, they said, "Where's your license?" And then she has got one. So she took his stuff and his scale mainly, which is very important, and grabbed it, and they were like a tug of war. And then she gave him a clapped him. Hey, and that was so humiliating. Right there in the public square, she clapped him. And they confiscated, the other officers took some of his stuff away. And he was so depressed, he was so broken that he went to the front of the governor's office and said, "Please, please give my stuff back, give my scale back at least so I can carry on my business." And some people came out and they punched and kicked him and so on. He was dejected, broken, went and got a liter of petrol and poured it on himself right there in the public square and set himself on fire. And a short while later, of course, he died in hospital. People in the country were shocked. Before he died, actually, there were demonstrations in his town. And this spread to other towns. And the president, Ben Ali, came quickly to the hospital to try to throw cold water on the whole issue. And he met Bouazizi, who had suffered 90% of burns. 90% of his body was burnt, and he died short while afterwards. And the demonstration spread throughout. The whole place was on fire. And Ben Ali's family was on fire. He married some very fancy hairdresser, and she and her family, her brothers and everybody, were cashing in big time, called state capture. State capture. They were going to town, so the family was very corrupt. And of course, he ruled as a ruthless dictator. for 23 years, since he came into power in 1987, he had three elections and he won 99.9% of the votes. Of course, it was all rigged. So that uprising was known as the Arab Spring. As I said, he packed up and also had to run to Saudi Arabia, where he died last week. Arab Spring, that's what it was called, and everybody thought, wow, you know what, we can get rid of our dictators. It inspired people in the region, in the whole region, in all the countries where there were dictators. So a short while later, it spread to Egypt. People thought, wow, you know what, we can also do the same thing. So a huge uprising took place. The 1 million people gathered in Tahrir Square, and the president at that time was Hosni Mubarak. And I don't want to go too much into detail, but the police started attacking the people, and many people were killed, and then the army came in and said, no, we'll take control, don't worry. And they deposed Hosni Mubarak, who was with the army in any case, right? He was the army's man. So they deposed him and said, right, you push off now and go to Sharm el-Sheikh and go and relax there. And then they said, okay, we're going to have democratic elections. And so democratic elections took place, everybody was happy, and they said, wow, this is our army. And unfortunately for the army, the most popular man in Egypt, of the Muslim Brotherhood, as it was known, the Ikhwan, Mohammed Morsi became president. And then, of course, you had what is called a deep state. All the different departments who were there for Mubarak's time, they started putting a stop to any kind of service delivery. Electricity was cut off for most of the day. Water was, taps were closed off and so on. So people were wondering, hey, we got this Morsi here and he's unable to deliver. And then the story was being circulated amongst the young people that he was going to bring in Sharia law, Islamic law into the country. And so the TV stations were all open to them, TV stations that belonged to Mubarak's buddies, and all the young people went there and they said, no, we have to have another demonstration against Morsi. And so there was another huge uprising, and the military said, no, we can't have this anymore, and therefore we have to remove Morsi. Well, they removed Morsi, and the whole government and all his colleagues and people of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they were all locked up. And as you heard, in June, Morsi passed away in prison. Well, after the Morsi was he was deposed, then you had a new leader. Of course, he came from the army, was general in the army, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the face of the Egyptian army. Well, as I said, it just takes a small spark to set off a forest fire. Well, on Friday, there seems to be, you heard already in the news now, I just tuned into your news, and it seems that it was also mentioned in the news that there's some sort of a forest fire starting in Egypt. Widespread demonstrations took place all over Egypt, Cairo and Alexandria and Suez and so on, against the rule of President Sisi. So what is the spark to these demonstrations that took place yesterday, that took place on Friday? What is the spark? The spark was a fellow called Muhammad Ali. No, not the boxer. Who is this guy? And what happened? Exactly what happened? Who is this guy? And what happened? Well, this guy posted some videos on Tuesday on social media, on Facebook. And in it he announced, this is last Tuesday, right? He said, if al-Sisi does not announce his resignation by Thursday, then the Egyptian people will come out to the square on Friday in protest, that is Tahrir Square. And he further said, your time is up. Talking to al-Sisi, your last date with the people of Egypt will be on Friday. He also demanded the release of all political prisoners in addition to army and police officers arrested for opposing the president. So who is this guy, Muhammad Ali, and why is he so cross, and where has he been sending the videos from, and so on? Well, let me then fill you in about this guy, because you're going to hear quite a lot about him. And this article says he's a whistleblower's video testimonies criticizing Egyptian leader Abdel Fattah al-Sisi have triggered an online movement called for the departure of the general-turned-president. Muhammad Ali, who's 42 years old, is an actor, former actor, film producer, and real estate investor who has been working in the construction sector in Egypt for the past 15 years. Well, according to his own account, he comes from a middle-class family from the Aguza neighborhood in the Giza governorate. His father, once Egypt's bodybuilding champion and the manager of Egypt's bodybuilding team, also worked as a gold seller in Cairo to support his family. Ali claims to have also excelled in a number of sports and says he was once a wrestling champion. As an actor, Ali had roles in 4 television series and 3 movies since 2013. His family was not wealthy enough to give him a high-quality education, he says, adding that he abandoned a degree in business administration at Cairo University after 2 years of study and worked in 14 different professions before moving into the construction industry. Right. He says he has never been a member of any political party and denies being an activist. In one of his videos, however, he says he took part in protests against then-President Mohamed Morsi in November 2012. Over 15 years, Muhammad Ali owned a construction company called AMLAC that worked with the Egyptian Army's Engineering Authority to implement mega projects across the country. Many of those projects include building residential homes and palaces for senior military officials, including Sisi, who previously served as head of the military intelligence apparatus and then Minister of Defense. Muhammad Ali did not respond to comments for this story. When approached to verify Ali's claims that his company was involved in building palaces for Sisi, the Egyptian government did not reply to the allegations. But Sisi seemed to confirm Ali's claims in his latest public remarks on the allegations. This was a big public meeting that took place last week, saying that his government had been building new palaces for the sake of Egypt, not for himself. He did not refute any of Ali's claims. He says, yes, I have built presidential palaces and will continue to do so. I am creating a new state. Nothing is registered in my name. It is built for Egypt. Muhammad Ali said in his first video that he is currently living with his 5 children in self-imposed exile in Barcelona, Spain, fearing for his family's safety after deciding to speak publicly about the projects that his company managed to get via the army. In April, he announced the opening of a Barcelona office. Actually, I'm not sure whether it's in this article, but it seems, oh, okay, we're coming to that. I just glanced at the bottom of the... In April, he announced the opening of a Barcelona office of his company, AMLAC, for investment and development. In an interview with Vanity Fair magazine in Spanish, he said his company's first project would be an international university on the coast of Barcelona. In his latest video on Friday afternoon, Ali said he has been on the run since his video went viral, and that he's constantly traveling between cities in Spain to avoid being captured by Egyptian government agents. He also said he's hiding his children at an unknown location to protect them. Well, in a series of videos posted on Facebook and YouTube since September 2nd, Ali began by accusing top army generals of failing to pay him millions of dollars for a number of projects his company built in collaboration with the army. Ah, so the army is owing him couple of million dollars. While demanding to be paid about 200 million Egyptian pounds, that's about $12 million, he revealed the purported budgets. Ah, whistleblower, you see. He spoke about the budgets of several projects overseen by the army and implemented by his company. The projects, he said, were assigned directly to his company without feasibility studies or a competitive bid, meaning that he got the tenders directly from the army. Nobody else was given any chance to bid. While his testimonies included revelations about the expenditure of top military officials, his videos about Sisi's own palatial residences have sparked anger and highlighted a stark contrast between the president's claim that Egyptians are very poor and at the same time, he is spending on palaces. Ali worked with the army long before Sisi became president. In one video, Ali claims that Sisi ordered the building of a new luxury house for his family in the middle-class Hilmiya district in Cairo once he was appointed defense minister by the late President Mohamed Morsi in 2012. The cost of the project, he said, eventually was 60 million Egyptian pounds, which is 6 million dollars in 2012. He says the finishing of the palace coincided with the detailed Diya clashes between Morsi supporters and opponents on November 2012. But that Sisi and his wife visited the new house to give feedback on its furnishings. So, Sisi and his wife didn't want to stay in the house where Morsi stayed. Some pretty fancy place also belonging to the Egyptian government. So they told him to build a new one at the cost of $6 million. After he became president, Sisi allegedly ordered the construction of a new presidential residence in a seaside resort in Alexandria with a cost of £450 million, that is $15 million, despite the existence of an old presidential rest house in the same area. Other palaces built by Sisi included the new headquarters of the presidency in the new administrative capital and the summer presidential palace currently under construction in the new Alamein city located 120 kilometers west of Alexandria. Right, let me read a little bit more. Ali's videos in colloquial Egyptian Arabic, that means just so that he can reach the local people easily, and his body language have earned him a massive online following. So people in Egypt were following his Facebook postings of the video clips. His appeal not only stems from his exposure of the size of the projects overseen by the army, but the disparaging language that he used to refer to Sisi, describing him as a failed man, a disgrace, and a midget, and accused him of corruption and hypocrisy. Whoa, whoa, whoa. He said, this is Ayman Noor, who is also in exile. He was a politician and was trying to be a president also afterwards. He said, politicians and journalists have long criticized Sisi and leveled the same accusations against Sisi. But Muhammad Ali's testimony resonated. It connected more with the public because he is an eyewitness rather than a political analyst or observer or opposition activist. In his videos, Ali blames the corrupt system on Sisi as the army's leader and admits he was part of the system. We are all corrupt, but we are all not to blame. The system is to blame. He does not want to change the system. We need a new system. So, anyway, Muhammad Ali has a special charisma. Right, I'm just going to jump because we're coming to the ad. Within 2 weeks, he managed to assassinate the character of Sisi. This was told by military analysts. The impact of Ali's videos has been reflected in Sisi's remarks last week when he admitted that Ali's allegations might indeed shake the trust of junior officers in their leaders. Right. So we're going to get back to you after the ad break. Right. Welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture. So there you have it, folks. Muhammad Ali. Now that's a heavy punch from Muhammad Ali. Heavy punch from Muhammad Ali. Not the boxer, but the whistleblower. Sending video clips from Barcelona speaking about corruption at the highest level, and therefore he has rallied the people of Egypt. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen next? Is this a new revolution? Arab Spring Part 3 in Egypt? Will the army and police crack down heavily as it did in the past? Will there be blood in the streets of Cairo? Will the Sisi government fall? Or will the whole thing just die down? This is a story to follow very closely. In fact, before I came here to the studio, I heard an analyst saying, and he's got his finger on the pulse of what's happening in Egypt, and he said that perhaps there hasn't been a crackdown, a heavy crackdown from the army and police, because maybe they are also listening to all of this and realize that, no, we can't attack our people this time because there's something wrong at the highest level in the military. So maybe that's the reason why there's no action. But who knows? As I said, follow the story very carefully. Many young people came out into the streets to bring down Mubarak, and mainly young people brought down Morsi. And once again, the streets of Cairo are filled with young people who realize that nothing has changed since the Mubarak era. And in fact, things have become worse. The freedoms that they hoped for have not materialized. And the economy has gone down seriously. Inflation is high and therefore unemployment is also very high. In fact, official statistics released in July indicate that one in three Egyptians is in poverty. Now, Sisi earlier this year changed the constitution so that he could stay in power until 2030. So the fed up factor has brought people into the streets once again. And the spark, tiny spark, was Muhammad Ali. You know, a thought occurred to me. President Ben Ali went into exile because of the revolution in Tunisia. President Ben Ali went into exile because of the revolution in Tunisia. Muhammad Ali, in exile in Spain, has sparked a revolution against the president of Egypt. What do you think of that? Let me tell you about another small spark that started a forest fire around the world. A very small spark. Her name is Greta Thunberg. Greta Thunberg. She's 16 years old. She's from Sweden. She is an environmental activist, and she has been speaking out about the risks of climate change and how the world is fast heading for disaster. She is holding politicians to account for their lack of action on the climate crisis. Her words have inspired millions of people around the world. Marches and rallies took place on Friday, yesterday, in more than 163 countries, from Sydney to Manila to Dhaka to London to Johannesburg. In New York alone, 250,000 people took part. Yes, sir. A small spark, small little girl, Greta Thunberg, 18 years old. Sorry, what am I saying? 16 years old. 16 years old. As I said before, and I could be wrong, there doesn't seem to be a strong Muslim voice regarding climate change and environment affairs. Maybe I'm wrong. Perhaps we should be having more lectures on this subject. What do you think? You know, I always think about this. Who in the world is responsible for ensuring that people are safe? People, nations are safe from suffering and oppression. Who's responsible for checking on this? And there are so many conflicts just right now, wars all over the world. After the First World War, we had something called the League of Nations. After the Second World War, we had the United Nations organization that promised to ensure world peace. What a useless organization. All it does is issue statements condemning some atrocity here or there. And the rich and powerful countries can put a veto, a stop to any action that could be taken. It's a mess. There is no international public protector. And so there's no one to protect the Rohingyas of Myanmar, or the Uyghurs of China, or the Palestinians, or the Syrians, or the Yemenis, or people in various African countries. Rich and powerful countries can literally get away with murder. Hey, that Bush, the second Bush, the small fellow, the shrub, he bombed Iraq to smithereens based on a lie. Weapons of mass destruction. What weapons of mass destruction? It was a lie. He spoke lies. He bombed Iraq, finished it up, reduced it to rubble, and nothing happened to him. He's a war criminal. Gaza was bombed for weeks and weeks. Thousands died. Nobody was called to account. Then there is the question of trying to make sense of what's happening on the international stage. There are so many conspiracies, and there are also so many conspiracy theories. For example, I read on social media at least a dozen theories about who bombed the Saudi oil field. And of course, all these theories sound quite plausible, quite acceptable. And all have their own particular biases. The drones came from Yemen, sent by the Houthis. No. It was Iran. No. It came from Iraq. No. It was Israel. The Saudis themselves did it to drive up the price of oil. Lots of theories. Just as we had lots of theories about what was commemorated this month, 9/11, the attack on the Twin Towers in New York, in which we are told 3,000 people lost their lives. 3,000 people. And of course, every year on September 11, the whole world is reminded about this terrible event. Every year. America is rich and powerful, so what happens to it must be highlighted, you see, must be remembered by the whole world. But terrible atrocities in other parts of the world are hardly ever commemorated. And more importantly, atrocities carried out by the United States itself are to be easily forgotten. Well, not on this program, Habibi. Not on this program. I will remind you. I will commemorate every year that which I consider to be a crime against humanity. You heard me describe every year in February what happened at the Al-Ibrahimi Masjid in Hebron, Palestine, in 1990, where Musallis were massacred by an Israeli army officer. In February 1991, there was a massacre in Iraq at the Al-Amariya bomb shelter, where bombs were dropped on a building that sheltered women and children. Bombs dropped by an American bomber plane. I have spoken every year about the massacre of Deir Yassin that took place in April 1948, when Zionist forces surrounded the small village and systematically massacred the inhabitants, old men, women and children. I will never stop reminding you about these tragic events. These were war crimes for which no one has been brought to justice, to account. I will do that every year to commemorate. We are forced to remember 9/11. As I said, 3,000 people perished. As I said, it happened on September 11th. Well, today, I want to remind you once again about what happened between September 16th to September 18th this past week, 37 years ago in 1982. About 3,000 people were slaughtered in a two-day orgy of killings. Two-day orgy of killings. This is a story of Sabra and Shatila, two Palestinian refugee camps in Beirut, Lebanon. But first, some background information. Oh, by the way, I've been to Beirut many, many times over the last 18 years. And as I pass Sabra and Shatila, I feel a deep sense of sadness, of depression, when I see the refugee camp. They're actually like small suburbs, roughly built suburbs. And as I pass it, I am really gripped by the horror that the people experienced there. Right, so some background information. When Israel was created in 1948 on 78% of Palestinian land, a Palestinian resistance movement, something like the ANC, started to grow. It eventually was known as the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, headed by Yasser Arafat. First, they launched attacks on Israel from Jordan. Then King Hussein kicked them out. So they moved to Lebanon, set up their headquarters in Beirut. And of course, we know that Lebanon has a border with Israel. And so they continued the attacks on Israel. The defense minister of Israel at that time was Ariel Sharon. He was determined to boot out the PLO from Beirut and wanted to install a puppet government in Lebanon that would be friendly towards Israel. Right. So in 1982, he took the whole Israeli army, tanks and everything, across the border and surrounded Beirut and bombed it for 10 weeks. Israeli jets pounded Beirut from the air, and in total, after the 10 weeks, 17,825 people, mainly civilians, were killed. The world was horrified, and eventually Israel was asked to hold fire, and America sent a whole lot of ships to Beirut, and Yasser Arafat and his men, I think there were around 10,000 of them, got onto these ships and departed for Tunisia, where they set up their headquarters. But that's not the end of the story. The Israeli army entered Beirut. Incidentally, Lebanon was already in a civil war from 1975 to 1990. It was, and the whole of Beirut was divided between different groups fighting each other. The fight was broadly between certain right-wing nationalist Christian groups known as the Christian Falanges and other Muslim and Maronite Christian groups. These Christian Falanges were closely allied to Israel. So Yasser Arafat and his men left Beirut, and as I said, it should have been all over, finished. But the Israeli army told the Christian Falanges militia, about 150 of them, to go into two Palestinian refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila, which is just on the outskirts of Beirut, and they told them, clean out the terrorists. Well, just before that, the leader of the Falanges, he was the leader, he was assassinated, nobody knows by whom, but the Falanges said the Palestinians must have done it, so they were all fired up when they entered the two camps, Sabra and Shatila, clean out the terrorists. And as you know, the Palestinians had fled to Beirut in 1948 when Israel was created, and also in 1967 when Israel captured the West Bank. Thousands ran for their lives. In Beirut, they made very rough jondols, and slowly these became block buildings, very rough ones with narrow gullies there and electric wires hanging all over. Terrible place with little or no water, very bad water in fact, and almost no sanitation. Really bad place, Sabra and Shatila. And still, that's the situation right now. And so the Israeli army surrounded these two refugee camps and allowed the Christian Falanges to enter. And then the massacres began over a period of 2 days. The Israeli army, knowing full well what was happening, they even fired flares into the air at night to help the Falanges carry out their slaughter. And, of course, they also occupied high buildings all around the camps and mounted large floodlights to help the Falanges move around easily. One of the first journalists to enter the Shatila camp was Robert Fisk. I'm sure you all know Robert Fisk. He's an internationally renowned journalist based in Beirut. I met him a few times already. Really, really great guy, very committed to exposing injustice in the Middle East. So Robert Fisk entered and he wrote this article. He said, what we found inside the Palestinian camp at 10 o'clock on the morning of September 1982 did not quite beggar description. It was a war crime. We were so overwhelmed by what we found in Shatila that at first we were unable to register our shock. Bill Foley of Associated Press had come with us. All he could say as he walked around was, Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ. Isa alayhi salam. Of course, he said Jesus Christ over and over again. That's how shocked they were. We might have accepted evidence of a few murders, even dozens of bodies killed in the heat of combat. But there were women lying in houses with their skirts torn up to their waist and their legs wide apart. Children with their throats cut. Rows of young men shot in the back after being lined up at an execution wall. They were babies, blackened babies, because they had been slaughtered more than 24 hours earlier, and the small bodies were already in the state of decomposition, tossed into rubbish heaps alongside discarded U.S. Army ration tins, Israeli Army equipment, and empty bottles of whiskey. Just inside the southern entrance to the camp, there used to be a number of single-story concrete walled houses. I conducted many interviews in these hovels in the late 1970s. When we walked across the muddy entrance to Shatila, we found that these buildings had been dynamited to the ground. There were cartridge cases across the main road. I saw several Israeli flare in canisters still attached to the tiny parachutes. Clouds of flies moved across the rubble. Down a laneway to our right, no more than 50 yards from the entrance, there lay a pile of corpses. There were more than a dozen of them, young men whose arms and legs had been wrapped around each other in the agony of death. All had been shot point-blank range through the cheek, the bullet tearing away a line of flesh up to the ear and entering the brain. Some had vivid crimson or black scars down the left side of their throats. One had been castrated, his trousers torn open, and a settlement of flies throbbing over his torn intestines. The eyes of these young men were all open. The youngest was only 12 or 13 years old. They were dressed in jeans and colored shirts. The material absurdly tight over their flesh now that their bodies had begun to bloat in the heat. They had not been robbed. On one blackened wrist, a Swiss watch recorded the correct time, the second hand still ticking round uselessly, expending the last energies of its dead owner. On the other side of the main road, up a track through the debris, we found the bodies of five women and several children. The women were middle-aged and their corpses lay draped over a pile of rubble. One lay on her back, her dress torn open, and the head of a little girl emerging from behind her. The girl had short, dark, curly hair. Her eyes were staring at us, and there was a frown on her face. She was dead. Another child lay... This thing is really getting me all choked up. Another child lay on the roadway like a discarded doll, her white dress stained with mud and dust. She could have been no more than 3 years old. The back of her head had been blown away by a bullet fired into her brain. One of the women also held a tiny baby to her body. The bullet had passed into her breast, had killed the baby too. Someone had slit open the woman's stomach, cutting sideways and then upwards, perhaps trying to kill her unborn child. Her eyes were wide open, her dark face frozen in horror. When does a killing become an outrage? When does an atrocity become a massacre? Or, put another way, how many killings make a massacre? 30? 100? 300? When is a massacre not a massacre? When the figures are too low, or when the massacre is carried out by Israel's friends rather than Israel's enemies. That, I suspect, was what this argument was about. If Syrian troops had crossed into Israel, surrounded a kibbutz, and allowed their Palestinian allies to slaughter the Jewish inhabitants, no Western news agency would waste its time afterwards arguing about whether or not it should be called a massacre. But in Beirut, the victims were Palestinians. The guilty were certainly Christian militiamen from which particular unit we are still unsure. But the Israelis were also guilty. If the Israelis had not taken part in the killings, they had certainly sent militia into the camp. They had trained them, given them uniforms, handed them U.S. Army rations and Israeli medical equipment. Then they had watched the murderers in the camps. They had given their military assistance. The Israeli Air Force had dropped all those flares to help the men who were murdering the inhabitants of Sabra and Shatila. And they had established military liaison with the murderers in the camp. Oof, I feel all choked up. And yes, that was a report by Robert Fisk. Once the world's media entered the camp and reported what happened there, quite remarkably, even in Israel, people were so horrified that even in Israel, 400,000 people marched in Tel Aviv. A commission was set up to investigate the massacre. It eventually concluded that Ariel Sharon was indirectly responsible for the killings of Sabra and Shatila, and he was forced to resign as defense minister. Do you think that he disappeared from the public eye because of this disgraceful judgment? He was booted out? About his involvement in this massacre? You think he would just disappear? Not at all. The Israelis have short memories. Ariel Sharon was elected as Prime Minister of Israel in 2000. But many in the world call him the Butcher of Beirut or the Butcher of Sabra and Shatila. In January 2006, he suffered a massive stroke that left him in a vegetative state. He remained in a coma for 8 years and died on the 11th of January 2014. And I always wonder when he was in the state of coma, in the vegetative state, in the coma, whether he was hearing the cries, the screams of those who were massacred in Sabra and Shatila. Dear people, please remember what happened on September 16 to 18, 1982. And right now, if you want, you can put into the word Sabra, S-A-B-R-A, or Shatila, S-H-A-T-I-L-A, onto your mobile or computer and see the horror photos and videos of the massacre. Absolutely chilling. Right, so I'm going to end there, and I want to tell you about another very important date, and that is next week, 24th of September. Why is it a holiday? Why is it a holiday? You don't know? No. That's not the reason. The reason why it's a holiday is because it's my birthday. Hey, I don't know where the 45 years went. Or was it 43 or 46? I don't know where the 45 years went. Right? We're ending now with light at the end of the tunnel. Right, let's see what we've got for you here. Let's see the first one. Did you hear about the new restaurant that opened in Durban? It's called Karma. Karma. It got no menus. You get what you deserve. And there was a small boy, Imran, and he asked his grandfather, "Hey, Nana, Nana, how old you are?" And Nana said, "Hey, I am so old, I can't remember my age anymore." And Imran said, "Nana, you must look in your underpants." And Nana was surprised and said, "My underpants?" And Imran said, "Yes, Nana, mine says 3 to 4 years. Right. A Catholic church minister, a Hindu priest, and a Maulana decided to see who is the best at his job. So they decided that they would go into the forest and each one will look for a bear and convert it. Right? A few hours later they met. The Catholic minister said, "When I found the bear, I read to him from the Bible and touched him with a crucifix. The next step is that next week he will be coming to church for communion." And the Hindu priest said, "I found a bear and shouted some scriptures at him and lit agarbatti. And next step, next weekend, the bear will be coming to the temple to take special bath." Then they looked at the Maulana. He was lying on the ground, very badly bruised, and his face swollen, and arms and legs in plaster. In a voice full of passion, he said, "You know, come to think of it, I shouldn't have started with the circumcision." This is A.P. Dawji. Bidding you all, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.